Fallon has the latest on more big names banned for live golf.
How satisfying is it for you to stand here at the end of the season and win this year's FedEx Cup?
It means an awful lot. I believe in the game of golf. I believe in this tour in particular. I believe on the players, I believe in the players on this tour. It's the greatest place in the world to play golf, bar none. And I've played all over the world.
The resounding vote of confidence for the PGA Tour from Rory McIlroy. In soccer, Paul Corrie and David Connolly are with us to talk big money signings, FAI Cup drama, and finally, Liverpool's first win of the season.
It's another goal. Luis Diaz, near post header. And Bournemouth have conceded 9. And it is a record-equalling margin of victory in the Premier League.
Plus in rugby, Keane Tracy is in studio to review the Irish defeat in Japan, Argentina's win in New Zealand, and reports of an Irish mini-tour to South Africa. If you want to get in touch, you can text us on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FM.
GameOn2FM.
Now, welcome along. It is great to be in the company of Ruby, as always, but we also have two very special guests in the studio for the first time in a while. It is nice to have two smiling faces across from me in studio. Paul Corrie and Keane Tracy are with us to reflect on a very busy weekend of rugby and football action. And Ruby's here, as always.
What was your highlight, Marie?
My highlight was Rory McIlroy. I just really like Rory McIlroy, and I never understand all those people that don't, or why he divides the nation so much. I just think he's one of the good guys, and I really like seeing him win. Every time he goes out to play, I want him to win. And Keane is a journalist as well, so he can relate to this story. But as journalists, we're always asking people for interviews, and more often than not, they say no. But every now and again, And you forget them. You forget them because it happens so often when people say no, it just, you know, they go out of your head. But in 2009, I had to go to the Irish Open. I was on work experience in TV3 and I was supposed to interview John Daly. And I was delighted with myself, I was on work experience, getting the chance to interview him. And when I got there, he just said he didn't want to do it. So I had gone all the way up there and I had nobody to interview. And I spotted Rory McIlroy walking across the course. And I ran over and asked him for the interview, and he said yes, and he did it, and he was so nice, and he gave me his time. And ever since then, it has stuck with me, because he was just one of the good people that said, yep, he could see, I told him what had happened, he could see I was in a bit of a jam, and he helped me out. And ever since then, I won't hear a bad word said about him.
It's just because you're Irish, Marie.
No, and it is. And even Ruby, like, I remember around that time as well, been sent to Fairy House, one of these Easter Monday races.
That'll be Grand National Day.
Grand National Day, yeah. That'll be the one. That will tell you now how much horse racing knowledge I had. And I had to interview you, and I remember being absolutely a nervous wreck, because you had such a reputation of, you know, being difficult at times. or, you know, if I was afraid I was going to ask a stupid question, because I know how you don't suffer fools. And if somebody asks a stupid question, you'll tell them it's a stupid question. But you were really nice. And like from that day, like my opinion changed completely of you, because
there's a big difference in someone asking you a stupid question and someone saying to here, look, I'm sorry, I don't know much about this. So straight away, you're going to give them a hand. But it's someone that sits down and pretends they know everything and then ask you a stupid question, you're kind of going, you'd be better off if you just pretend, if you stop pretending that you know. So that was always my attitude.
Okay,
sorry.
Well,
so
you were very...
That's what you got. You were honest. That's what you got on with me.
It was very clear anyway that I was there to do a job and I was going to try and do the best job that I possibly could. But you made it very easy for me. So ever since then, with you as well, I always thought, okay, look, he's one of the good people. And then as it turned out, when I did start working with you, you weren't that bad. And
wasn't that bad. That's not exactly a resounding vote of confidence. It wasn't that bad. I don't know. Does Rory divide opinion because he probably doesn't, or even though he's won so much, maybe won as much as he could?
Yeah. It's probably as well because, you know, the time with the Olympics too, I think Keane's probably is nodding here as well. He's probably aware of it from the bit in the media at the time. And he didn't really nail his Irish colours to the mast as much as people wanted to, and that didn't help his case.
That's a political minefield. I remember looking at that thinking, oh God, I'd hate to be Rory McIlroy.
Yeah, well, it's Ireland, so it was obviously going to divide people. And look, he's quite outspoken as well. And, you know, he doesn't tell people what they want to hear. He tells people what he thinks, and that often doesn't go down well, too.
To be fair to him, he's Northern Irish, and he kind of wants to be Northern Irish.
Well, he did explain it quite well at the time, that is exactly who he is. And, you know, he'd have grown up in a situation that would have formed views that he had. But he did ultimately play for Ireland. So, I mean, that was obvious how he felt when he did that.
Well, you know, I had the pleasure of meeting him, and he's a gentleman, as you have described him. And I, like you, am always shouting for Rory McIlroy. But there's times I think, oh, Rory, come on. You're the best player in the world. You just win a bit more.
Yeah. It's not that easy, though, Ruby.
No. Wish it was. Life would be simple if it was, wouldn't it?
I was on with the two Johnnies a bit earlier. Are your new friends? My new friends, yeah. They're always nice, by the way. And we were talking about Rory McIlroy and winning all the money. And I was just making the comparison that, like, he reached, you know, the top of his game in the sport that he chose. You reach the top of your game in the sport that you chose. He came away with 18 million after a weekend. I'm sure you did well in your career, but, like, obviously it's completely different levels of money. It's like mind-blowing stuff. Did you ever think, like, maybe if you'd applied yourself to a different sport that you could have succeeded and came away with 18 million after a couple of holes of golf or anything like that?
If you watch me playing golf, I most certainly would never have got rich playing golf, Marie. What else?
Do I
wish my sport paid more than it did? Do I wish it was on a par with golf or with soccer, or I suppose we never give it the credit, but globally with cricket? Yeah, of course I wish it was, but it wasn't. It was national hunt racing, and it is what it is. I mean, do you think sometimes GAA players stand in Crow Park, 3,000 people more, and think, imagine if we were getting paid for this.
They'd have to.
I definitely got on better than they did.
So many of them are so talented. Like, and as you said, like, cricket is one there. Like, you know, when you look at hurlers, the skills that they have, if they were able to apply themselves to something that was as global as cricket, a lot of them would be doing all right. And obviously then a lot of players as well would have done well in... Well, a lot of Gaelic football players, you'd think, would have done okay in soccer.
A couple of feet smaller and had gone to Japan, like, Yutaki Taki would be on the same level of income and status in Japan as any footballer or golfer.
All right. So you're too big.
Too big in the wrong country.
Right. Keane Lynch, I suppose, is one that comes to mind. Like, he went and was quite good at soccer and went on a few trials and ultimately focused on hurling and is arguably up there as one of the greatest to ever play the game. You just wonder if somebody like him had decided to stick with the soccer. Paul Curry, what do you reckon? Can hurlers play soccer?
Hurling's easier. Didn't David Clifford
text us on 51552 if you agree with Paul Curry?
David Clifford, for sure.
Played Kennedy Cup.
Yeah.
Centre half, which I always find is amazing when you see him playing Gaelic football now, and he's such a sharpshooter, and then you think he was actually centre half and was very good by all accounts. And you probably know, didn't he play against a serious Dublin team that a few lads went on, I think, the year he played? You never know, real sliding doors moment probably for him as well.
But John Cooper. Egan as well.
Yeah,
you know, John Egan's obviously very accomplished Gaelic footballer.
Shane Long. Yeah, that's another one. Okay, well, I just thought that was quite an interesting one when I was watching Rory and chatting to Ruby today. It did come to mind about whether or not our sports people who reach the top of their game could have made it in different sports, and what would they have done. Ruby, what was your highlight?
Yeah, the golf last night as well, Marie. Must say I got a good kick out of watching Argentina beating the All Blacks. That was enjoyable. United won. It was a good weekend, but it was a quiet weekend on sport for me, wasn't it?
Yeah, definitely. It was yesterday in particular was a quiet one. There wasn't as many box office Premier League games as the day before. And sure, when the GAA goes away,
Sunday in August, what should it have
been? The GAA goes away and rugby hasn't really started yet, then there is that little bit of a void where it's quiet, but also an opportunity for other sports then to shine. I was watching the news last night and I saw the triathlon was on, which is a rare enough occurrence to see a mass participation sport that wouldn't be as high profile to make the 6 o'clock and 9 o'clock news.
Well, I was at the Pony Club eventing championships in Fairy House, and from what I could see, there must have been 500 kids there. There was ponies everywhere. So that was my weekend.
Right. Lads, any sporting highlights?
Haaland from Amory. I just think, you know, when you've seen people watching the Community Shield and laughing at him, putting up reels of, you know, what a waste of money, and he's got 6 goals now in 4 league games. He just looks like an absolute beast.
He does.
Another dimension to Man City, so an unbelievable performance from him.
He seems unreal almost. I know one of the managers over the weekend, I'm not sure who it was, described him as being like an alien species, because it's like he's bigger, faster, better and stronger than everybody else.
Yeah, and you see that in the types of goals that he scores. I mean, we've seen kind of that poacher's instinct of being in and around the 6-yard box and picking up the tap-ins that maybe Man City have missed out on over the last 12, 24 months. But you also see then the power of the man. Mm-hmm. Like the last goal he scored, where Gundogan has put him through, and Joel Ward is almost like piggybacking Haaland, and he just can't get near him. And then he brushes him off and 3 touches and he finishes. And if you actually look at his overall involvement in the game, probably not a huge amount of touches, doesn't need to get too involved in it. But once he gets half a chance, you know, he gets a sniff and he just puts it away, and he's, you know, people maybe asked about what was lacking from Man City last year, and it looks like Haaland's probably brought them on another level.
There's a good documentary on YouTube about his early years, and like obviously he has the genetics, and mum being a world champion cross country skier and the dad being a Premier League footballer, but he just seemed to have been managed really well the whole way through his career as well, like from earlier on, I'd say, just from the physical capabilities that he had, and obviously the interest in the game as well, that they were fairly sure that he was destined to go on and play it at a level, and he was guided and managed throughout his whole career as well, and that's detailed in the documentary. We might tweet it out a little bit later on, but it's well worth just checking out, because it's a rare enough thing that you can that players, when they are destined, that they actually go on, and he looks like he's going to fulfil his potential.
Ah, yeah, and listen, his dad obviously has the benefit of playing in English football, but even when you look at the moves that he's had, you know, starting off at Salzburg, and he maybe could have taken a bit of a bigger jump at the time, but the decision to go to Borussia Dortmund, mm-hmm. obviously a place where talent is nurtured very well. You look at Jadon Sancho, yeah. Jude Bellingham, Haaland, and then the timing of the move to Man City. It just looks like such a good fit. He, like you said, like he actually looks as if he was creating a lab to be a centre forward for the Premier League. He just has all the attributes to be an absolute top player. His attitude seems 10 out of 10, and you put it all together, you've just got a world class athlete with a special, special talent.
Yeah, actually, you probably nailed it there, that his talent was nurtured, because that's not always the case, that talent is nurtured in the way that his was, and that's really clear from watching him growing up and what he was exposed to. And you know, often when kids are really good, they're not brought on as much, you know, and he was playing up and playing on the right teams and exposed to the professional environments at the right stage that he needed to.
It's his attitude as well, Paul. It's like he just loves playing football.
Yeah.
To watch him play, it's not so much like it's about him. Like, you look at other naturally talented people, like Paul Pogba springs to mind. Yeah. I know he was in the news today, but you just look at his attitude compared to other players, and you think, wow, he just loves what he's doing.
Yeah, he absolutely does. And there's so many players, Ruby, who would get so disinterested in the game and maybe lose a bit of focus with the lack of touches that he actually had on the weekend just gone by. And his concentration, his attitude, everything that you've mentioned there is top class. And to be honest with you, you don't walk through the door at Manchester City under Pep Guardiola unless that is the case. You see it right throughout the team. Bernardo Silva, the distance he covers, Phil Foden, the attitude that he has shown. And the second that maybe that starts to waver, the second that that starts to fall below the level of acceptance, you're shown the door. And they've just got a world-class culture, world-class environment within Man City that anything less than that is unacceptable. So it's a perfect marriage, and it was the perfect timing for Haaland to go to Man City. Like, any sort of fine-tuning that needed to be done seemed to take place at Borussia Dortmund. Any mistakes that needed to be made were happening probably at a lesser level than the Premier League. The Premier League is so cutthroat now for young players that if you get in and you have 2 or 3 good games, all well and good. If you had 2 bad games, you come out of the team, and it's hard to get back in. So
he matured as well from just the personal point of view, because there was a stage there when he was in Germany and he was doing his post-match interviews and he was answering the questions with one word, and he seemed like a bit of a petulant child, but like that was obviously immaturity and he had to come through that, and it was probably good timing as well that he wasn't doing that over here, that it was in Germany, and maybe he didn't have the focus and the glare and the hate then that comes in Premier League football with it. He seemed to have outgrown that now, and he is dealing with everything an awful lot better than he did seem to in Germany. But he also seems to not take himself overly seriously either. Like, it's kind of that kid is, as Ruby said, you know, the kid is still in there. You know, he seems to have a bit of a personality and be a bit of a joker, and he doesn't mind letting that side of him out too, which you get to see from social media. And look, maybe it's all managed and it's just part of the brand. And, you know, he said in the past that he wants to talk to his fans through his own channels and doesn't like doing the interviews because, you know, he feels that he's not being as authentic with his following as he is when he is on the, you know, his Instagram and all the rest. But then the other side of it is maybe that is his personality. Maybe, you know, he is joking about the Percy Pigs that he seems to be really interested in and things like that. And look, he's a young person at the end of the day, and he still has grown up to do. It'll be interesting to see how he manages that now. And you'd have to think, though, they'll probably keep him away from Jack Grealish.
Oh, well, listen, if he stays injury-free, there's so much more to come. So much more.
Yep. God, he was somebody. Look at what Grealish cost at 100 million. And he is an incredible talent. But then you look what Haaland cost. I mean, there's good buys and there's maybe all right ones, but when you look at the list of Premier League players and different prices that people play, you look at Lukaku, the money he made on a couple of occasions, Grealish, Pogba, Harry Maguire, like, Haaland doesn't even make the top 10.
Yeah, and it probably brings you nicely onto Anthony then at Manchester United. You look at just the way that Man City conduct their business, they seem to do it really early with any transfer window that opens up, and they seem to be really good at what they do.
There's no desperation there, though. You see, like, remember the whole saga with Harry Kane last year? You know, yeah, they didn't really need him, even though they did need that number nine. They seemed to have a plan B, C, D, and whether it was Haaland coming down the track or whatever. While Manchester United, it feels like it's desperate.
Yeah, it seems very reactionary. But the way the transfer window has gone there, it's just absolutely bonkers. Like, there's a transfer market for the English Premier League and the pricing of players coming into the league, and then there's kind of like another window for every other team. But the prices that are being thrown around are absolutely scandalous. And when you think of the money that City had to pay on Haaland in order to get their business done, like, it wipes any other transfer from this window under the table. But you're right, they're very good at what they do. Liverpool are very similar in that sense. They ID a player, they look at a position where maybe somebody is coming towards the end of their career. Look at even Fernandinho left the building, Calvin Phillips was in very soon, same sort of fit, same sort of mould. Same with Liverpool haven't rushed to sign a centre midfielder because I guess the objective is that they bring Jude Bellingham into the building in 12 months' time, and they don't see the need to rush. Whereas on
although
the opposite,
that might have changed, though, because Klopp did say after the 9-0 win that he has admitted that they do need a midfielder. Now, whether they'll get one now,
yeah, that will be interesting, because they did that stopgap with the centre halves, and that didn't work out. So whether or not they try to do that again, but if you just look at Chelsea, look at Manchester United, everything is so reactionary. It's just trying to fill the gaps, and I mean, the pricing that are being thrown around at the moment, Anthony, for what is it, close to 100 million euro, is just bonkers. Now, obviously, Ten Hag has identified a player that he wants. Manchester United have done well to go out and get him, but if it doesn't go well, you know, this is going to be something that is going to be brought back to the price they've paid. Mm-hmm. His statistics aren't massively impressive for playing with Ajax, who are a team that dominate the Dutch division. He hasn't scored a huge amount of goals. He looks quite light as well. So it's going to be tricky for him coming across from the Dutch league, thrown into the Premier League, massive price tag, huge pressure on his shoulders.
David Connolly joins us on the line as well. David, Man United got their second win of the season in Southampton on Saturday morning. Great goal from Bruno Fernandes, but they were kind of hanging on a little bit, were they?
Yeah, good evening, everyone. To be honest, I think they were probably, I wouldn't say lucky to play Southampton, because they played quite well, but I mean, Southampton are one of those sides, I think, if you're looking to win two in a row and win away from home, probably St Mary's is the place where you'd want to go. And look, they scored a really good goal. You know, you can't take that away from them, but, you know, massive 3 points for them. I mean, to pick up six was huge, you know. Can you imagine the intensity that Ten Hag has been through? Well, everyone knows, we've read it. Phil column inches after the Brentford game. And they have, no matter what you say, you know, they have bounced back. Brilliant against Liverpool. Another 3 points was really important for them. And, you know, they've got Leicester next. And if you look at how Leicester are doing, you know, I know they lost at the weekend, they were okay, but they're in a bit of a bad place. So, you know, they could have 9 from 9, realistically, by Thursday.
Looking at them, Paul, and just seeing how they are starting to improve, and it looks like Anthony's going to be there, and Casemiro, where are their weakest links now?
I still think they're short in that final third. I mean, the spine of the team always needed a lot of work coming into the start of the season. I think there's been, you know, there's been a noticeable difference in the last two games that they've gone back to the basics of probably playing a bit more direct, playing a bit more percentages, not rolling the ball out from the back like we saw out of Brentford and getting caught out. And you would presume that's because Ten Hag doesn't feel that they have the personnel to play that way at this moment in time. Now, don't get me wrong, they'll blood in the likes of Casemiro and they'll blood in the likes of Antony in order to maybe get to where he sees the team playing further down the line. But you would still feel that there may be a couple of players short. I always think in the top end of the pitch, there doesn't seem to be the same sort of structure or precision to their play that you would see with the likes of Man City and Liverpool. And in order to maybe get to that next level, they need probably players who are going to be able to sustain those attacks and pin teams in and maybe play with a bit more intelligence. So I think a number 9 would slot quite nicely in there. If you're going to have Antony and Alanga, Rashford and Martial maybe combining with that number 9, that's potentially some addition that you might see in the next couple of days. But they've signed 5 players, Marie. Like, it's a lot of players in one transfer window. There's a lot of money spent, so you can't, I guess, always be asking and asking to sign more. But they certainly need a couple more players if they're kind of bridge that gap to the top four.
So when you let Paul Pogba off on a free, you then give him 97 million to get him back. Sure. Well, what's buying 5 more players? That's just the way United do business, by the looks of it. But anyway, that was United. Liverpool 9-0, David, on Saturday. They looked lacking in energy, tired against Manchester United last Monday, but it was a completely different team or attitude or something at Anfield on Saturday, because they were just out of the traps and gone.
Yeah, exactly. I think they, you know, the start was really important for them and they got off to a great one. You have to say, though, that, you know, clubs like Bournemouth, I know afterwards sort of Scott Parker was saying, you know, I don't know if I have enough to compete. Well, I think it's different competing against Liverpool and Man City's, but it's how you compete against everyone else. But I just think they were blown away. The difference that those top two, you know, let's just take Liverpool and Man City, the difference those top two have compared to everyone else. You know, going to Anfield, I know Scott Parker got a result there last time, but, you know, I think Liverpool were in a different place then. I think it was lockdown. I mean, they were just sensational. Like, he made the changes. He bought Fabinho, I think was the right call. They got off to a flyer and, you know, scored all sorts of goals. Goals from distance, you know, brilliant finishes from Trent. Little poke, like toe-ins, pokings in the box, headers. You know, had a mix of everything. And they were sensational, Liverpool.
They really were, but you can't help but feel for Travers, Paul. And I think especially when you just consider the weekend that Bizzouni had to, you know, he was getting so much praise. And then the other side of it, for his performance against United, you have Travers letting in 9 goals.
God, your heart went out for him, didn't it? It really, really did. Now, there's probably not too much he could have done about the majority of the goals. I thought maybe the 2 Firmino goals, the first one, it's kind of looped up and Firmino's poked it in from about 5-6 yards and you're maybe looking for your goalkeeper to come and be a bit more commanding in the area. And then the other one where he's maybe parried it into the 6-yard box, but it's very hard to be critical. I mean, he was getting absolutely rained on with shots and chances, and he did well to maybe claw 1 or 2 of them. But a very difficult situation for Travis. Your main worry would be that Bournemouth heading into their next fixture, they've brought in a goalkeeper. Is he going to come out as starting 11? I mean, he was superb for them last year, so you would hope that Scott Parker will have a bit of loyalty. But yeah, that would be my only worry. But there'll be easier days to come from Mark Travers than Liverpool at Anfield.
I don't think you can really just blame the keeper for Saturday though, can you?
No, they're back. I mean, they went with a back 5 and they were really poor. At times they were sitting extremely deep and they didn't make things easy for them. I think, Ruby, when the first goal goes in so early, it maybe it changes the game plan of what it is Scott Parker had set out, and that didn't help. But yeah, you're right, the defending was absolutely diabolical all through the game.
It was like the perfect storm, David, really, wasn't it? Because you have Liverpool with the bite in them wanting to come out and prove a point, and then when things start to fall apart, it's so hard to get it back on track. And then the worry for other teams is that was without Salah, well, scoring a goal, I mean.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you know, a lot's been made of, and I think it's right of Man City bringing in, you know, Haaland, who, I mean, he'll get 30. I dread to think how many goals he'll get. Probably could be touching 40, I don't know. But, you know, so the challenge will be for Liverpool and Salah, obviously, keeping up. Now, he has got a couple under his belt, but, you know, without Mane, I sort of thought that, you know, that's a fair chunk of goals that they're going to have to you know, supplement with, I don't know, Darwin Núñez or Diaz or someone has to bring them. I think they'll get those goals again this season. It's just whether, you know, anyone is ever really going to slip up, say, how many points will Man City drop? You know, and it's interesting because, say, West Ham played Man City and they thought, right, we'll sit back, a bit like Paul saying there about conceding early. West Ham sat back and hoped to absorb Man City for 90 minutes or get to half time, and then they conceded and it was game over. You know, 2-0 could have been 4-0, 5-0, but Newcastle kind of went for Man City, and Palace went for Man City. So I think we've seen that there's a bit of vulnerability, no matter, you know, about all the great stars and all the money they've spent. Kind of both teams, Liverpool losing to United, you know, City conceding a couple, okay, but they got it done against Palace. But you just wonder if you can go toe-to-toe with them, you know, if you've got a couple of, like, talented players like Saint-Maximin for Newcastle, or, I mean, Palace didn't even have Zaha, but if they did, you know, you just think that they still might be, you know, they're going to be there, like, running away with it. But I still think if you went for them, you know, there is a little bit of a vulnerability about both, that on their day, if you've got a couple of top players, you might be able to test them. But I think for the likes of Bournemouth, I just think it's too much of a stretch, I think. I think the gap is really big. And I think Scott said that himself, that they look, you know, really short.
David brings us nicely on to Crystal Palace and Man City. Obviously, there were two down at half-time. Then Bernardo Silva gets a solo effort all on his own. Bit of a deflection, but he still gets them back in the goal. And then your highlight of the weekend, and Haaland. And I thought for his second goal in particular, like he just lost all the defenders. He was standing on his own on the six-yard box. It was just how he moved away to find the space for himself. It was, I thought, magic to watch.
Yeah, it was. I mean, it was a funny one because I'm sure there was a lot of people at home looking at a Palace 2-0 at half-time thinking, ah, City come back. It has that feeling there that, you know, even when they're playing Newcastle in 3-1, they think, ah, they'll create enough chances to get back into it. And that was the case on the weekend. But you're right. I mean, David would be able to speak far more eloquently about this than I would. But Haaland's knack, and you see it with Harry Kane, I think it was the week beforehand against Wolves, when he just peeled off Nathan Collins and he finds that space and he has that killer instinct of where the ball is going to drop. It was the same again on the weekend for Haaland in the Palace game. You know, the areas of that he's able to pick up, the supply line that he has, it's just the perfect recipe for Haaland to score so many goals within that team. And I don't know about City, like David mentioned there is a bit of vulnerability, particularly on transitions and pace, and saw on the weekend maybe to set pieces as well. But outside of that, their play is just incredible. They wear teams down, they take their legs away from them by killing them with the ball. And then when you have players like Bernardo Silva, Haaland, Foden, Mahrez, the list goes on, they're going to win so many games of football, and they're going to just walk all over teams. But Haaland was the one for me that really stood out. And I mean, David mentioned there, it's going to be interesting to see how many goals he actually clocks up this season.
Yeah, well, it feels like it's a really interesting Premier League season already. And look, we've mentioned the teams that are doing well at the top, but a lot of the conversation, David, is around Aston Villa and Steven Gerrard and whether or not time is running out for him. He said such a disappointing start to the season. Do you think he's the right man for the job there?
Well, Maria, I covered this game yesterday. I worked on it live, and I tell you what, it was a really bad performance from them. I mean, second half they were dreadful. You know, West Ham made a big call. They took off a new signing, changed their formation, went back to the sort of formation that they played last season so well, and they absolutely steamrolled Villa, who to be honest looked. You know, he's got two centre forwards he wants to get in the team. So how do you play with two strikers and with someone like Philip Coutinho? You know, so he sometimes plays a sort of four diamond two, very narrow. Other times, if he can't fit two strikers in, he'll put one wide or he'll drop one and play a 4-3-3. It seems like he can't work out his best shape. And also, they don't look as athletic as other teams or as big. I mean, they're a pretty small side. You go through the whole team, you know, whether it's Coutinho, Buendia, you know, or the front two, Douglas Luiz, you got McGinn. They're all pretty small, the two full, but like Luka Dinga is quite small. You know, they just seem to get overpowered in the second half. And I couldn't tell you how they play. I couldn't say they're a counter-attacking team because I don't think they are. They don't have natural width when they play a four-diamond two. They're not a ball possession team. They don't retain it well enough. They look a bit low in confidence. Do you know what? I'd be very worried for them because, you know, they got Arsenal up next. And the fans don't have any particular loyalty to Steve. He wasn't necessarily a former player or anything like that. And you know, after Arsenal, they got Man City. So, yeah, the games, these next two games are kind of as tough as they get, right? And what happens if he doesn't get any points there? I mean, I don't know. I worry for them because I didn't see any signs at all of any, you know, you couldn't tell me what, how they were playing, what they were playing for. No impact second half, no response. They were bad.
And Paul, Arsenal could well put the nail in Steven Gerrard's coffin because they are on a high. Guy came back from one down against Fulham, and they have Aaron Ramsdale in goal, who made two brilliant stops late on.
Yeah, and it's the type of game last year that potentially Arsenal might have folded when they went 1-0 down, and it was a terrible mistake from Gabriel. But what we have seen from Arsenal of this season, and potentially at times in the last kind of 12 months, is a bit more steel to their play, and you know, the energy and the respect seems to be back amongst the fans. But they've certainly added players in there. Martin Odegaard has been superb since the start of the season. He's obviously given them the captaincy, creating a lot of chances, and obviously on the end of scoring goals now. But a bit lucky with the nature of both goals, but Arteta will take that, and they probably deserve it, Ruby, based on how they've actually started the season. They look a far stronger outfit than they did last year. And you know, I keep going back to the documentary, but I have a certain kind of soft spot for Arteta and Arsenal now, and I think if they can add one or two more, I still think they're maybe short in centre midfield. If they were, I saw they were linked with Tielemans today, he'd be a superb signing for them, and potentially another centre half. They won't be too far off a top four, which I'm sure is the objective for them this season.
Okay, we are out of time for the Premier League. David Connolly, thank you so much for joining us. We will be talking to you soon, no doubt. Paul, just before we finish up on football news from Shamrock Rovers today, Andy Lyons is set to depart. He is going to Blackpool, not until January though, but he has been in such great form, it's no surprise really to see him moving on.
Yeah, and it's not. Blackpool came in from a couple of weeks ago, and I think this makes sense for Shamrock Rovers in the sense that they get to keep him for the European campaign. They're obviously going to sell him for quite a good fee, but the player deserves it. Andy's been superb last number of weeks, particularly the goal in Europe during the week. He was scored the winner in extra time against Drogheda yesterday. He's really pushing on and somebody to keep an eye on.
Blackrock boy, Blackrock College.
A Blackrock boy, yeah. Well, strange. I'm a Belvedere College boy.
With a round ball.
Yeah, it's strange to hear so many soccer players coming, or hear of soccer players coming through. Keane Trace, have you heard him anymore?
I was just telling you before we started actually that I was in Blackrock a couple of years ago and spotted that Alan Lee's jersey was hanging up in there, so I think he's one of the few who's been capped by Ireland. So yeah, it's pretty rare considering the amount of rugby players that come through with an enormous basis. Yeah.
I wasn't much of a rugby player, I can tell you that much.
Did you play at all when you were in Belvo?
No.
So what did you do when everyone else was playing rugby?
I played football
just by yourself.
I think they took a look at my legs and my arms and thought, nah, he's no good.
Michael Darren McCauley was another one, went to one of the rugby schools as well, and I remember reading about him when rugby was on. He was just shooting hoops by himself. So yeah, courses for courses and all of that. We will have the FAI Cup draw tomorrow as well, so do tune in for that. And there are three games in the League of Ireland tonight: Bowes playing St Pat's, Sligo Rovers and Dundalk, and Shelburne versus Derry City. We're going to take a very quick break, but do stay with us because we'll be looking back on all of the weekend's rugby action.
Game On 2FM. Welcome back to Game On. Keane Tracy is in studio with us. Keane, Ian Foster, who was handed a contract until the World Cup, Rugby World Cup, after the All Blacks beat the Springbok in Ellis Park, is under more pressure again after Argentina, or more likely Buffelli, kicked the ball more so than New Zealand could play rugby.
Yeah, and Ruby was probably the worst place that it could have happened as well, in Christchurch, because all the talk is, especially, like, I'm just actually back from New Zealand. I was over for the tour, and I can tell you, like, having been on the ground, there is a huge swell of support. A lot of supporters want to see Scott Robertson, who's the Crusaders head coach. They really want to see him come in now, sooner rather than later. I think the New Zealand Union probably have it more so for post-World Cup, but like New Zealand, I would say they still have plenty of time to turn it around, but there is a lot of unrest in the country. Like I said, having been over there, taxi drivers, it's all they want to talk about. Going through airport security, like, it's all they want to talk about. And it was actually my first time in New Zealand, and it becomes a little bit of a cliche that the people are obsessed with rugby, but when you get over and you get a taste of it, they really, really are. And like I said, there is a lot of people who don't want to see Ian Foster there. They think they're taking the team backwards at a rate of knots. You know, they had the win over South Africa was brilliant, and it had the potential to be, you know, a real kind of turning point, and, you know, it just didn't pan out like that. And like I said, it's the worst possible place for it to happen in, you know, Scott Robertson's home. And Argentina were fully deserved of the win. You know, Michael Checa has come in there. On the flip side, you know, it, like, all the kind of focus and heat is on Ian Foster, but you look at the job Michael Checa has done in Felipe Contepomi, of course, who's left Leinster, and he looks to have an immediate impact as well. So Argentina always tend to time their run in times for World Cups, as Ireland know probably better than most, and it looks like they're kind of doing it now again. But yeah, the All Blacks are going to play them again this weekend, and it would be unthinkable to think that they could lose back-to-back games against Argentina. They'd never lost to Argentina at home. They'd only lost to them the first time ever a couple of years ago, but that was in Sydney during kind of COVID time. So there's a lot of, the All Blacks are racking up a lot of unwanted records, losing to Ireland for the first time on home soil, losing a series to Ireland for the first time. So there is enormous pressure on Ian Foster, and the players have to take responsibility as well. They all, you know, loads of them came out after they beat South Africa and kind of say, you know, stood by our coach, which of course they're going to do. But there's just so much uncertainty, I would say, through the All Blacks team. Like, you go right the way through it, and I just don't think they've found the right combinations that they need. And yeah, pressure's on.
It's so rare to hear the word unrest being used when you're speaking about sport and reaction to sport, but it is quite fitting, I guess, when you're talking about New Zealand and rugby and what it means to them. What does it mean for our wins over them, though?
I don't think it should take anything away from it. And I was kind of wondering if this narrative would start breaking out, and I can kind of feel like maybe it is. There's no doubt that this isn't an All Blacks vintage team. And I think anyone who has watched the All Blacks over the last couple of years, particularly in November when they lost back-to-back games in Dublin and Paris, would have known that they were a team under pressure. But it shouldn't detract from Ireland going to New Zealand. They'd never won over there, let alone winning a series. They're still bloody hard to beat over there. But like I said, even after kind of the first test when he was over there, and particularly after the second test, you wouldn't believe the amount of Kiwis who said to me, like, deep down, I really want Ireland to win the series here, because they viewed it as if New Zealand were to lose at home to Ireland, Ian Foster would be gone. That was it. Now, that's very much like the feeling amongst, I would say, the casual person on the street, like I said, taxi drivers, people working in the airports and stuff. But they almost wanted them to lose so that Ian Foster would go and Scott Robertson could take over. But it hasn't happened. The New Zealand Union have, you know, said they're going to stand by him. So he's there until the World Cup. And obviously Joe Schmidt is coming now. And that was probably the most interesting aspect of, from a New Zealand point of view, it was the first time you saw him in the coach's box. And I think they conceded something like, their penalty count was enormous. I can't remember what it finished. And that is like the one thing I think that Joe Schmidt will come in and immediately fix. Like, he just doesn't tolerate that. You think back of to Ireland at their peak in 2018, they were like squeaky clean in terms of discipline, and he won't stand for stuff like that. So I still think with getting Joe Schmidt on board, like, there's a massive chance Ireland could meet the All Blacks if the draw kind of pans out in the quarterfinal in France next year. And I still would be kind of fearful of playing them kind of, you know, when it comes to the crunch.
That was the biggest difference on Saturday in Christchurch. It was just the discipline. I mean, it was penalties that kept Argentina in it. Emiliano Buffelli kicked 18 points. I mean, he was unbelievable from the tee, 6 from 6. But it was discipline more so than anything that was the difference.
Yeah, and like, of course, like, you know, the referee, the Georgian guy, Kieran Ashvili, kind of came under pressure. My pronunciation was definitely terrible for his name. But he came under a lot of pressure. You know, Ian Foster kind of threw in a couple of digs, but Michael Checa kind of hit back. And he was so right in kind of what he was insinuating. For years, the All Blacks have gotten away with a lot. We'll call it the dark arts, particularly around the breakdown at scrum. And I think now that there's no doubt that the aura around the sort of the All Blacks brand and stuff has been damaged, I would say, over the last kind of year or so. And I think referees are probably copping on to that as well. Even, you know, we saw the sending off in the second test over New Zealand against Ireland. I just don't think that might have happened a few years ago. So it was definitely their downfall, Ruby. You're right, especially with Buffelli kicking so well. But like, a Joe Schmidt team to have such poor discipline, and obviously it's not his team per se, but he's very much a part of the coaching staff, is unheard of. And I would imagine the Riot Act was read to them this week, and you'd be shocked if it wasn't, the discipline wasn't better this weekend.
It feels like it's a balanced rugby landscape at the moment.
Absolutely. That's been probably one of the most exciting things going into, like, it. Once the rugby season starts, we're in a World Cup year, essentially, and that is really, really exciting. The Rugby Championship has been absolutely bananas in terms of teams are really capable of beating each other, and that's what you want. For so long, the All Blacks were out in front as the best team, and no one could get near them now. So much of that is around kind of the mentality of the game as well, and I think there's no doubt that Ireland now no longer have a fear factor against the All Blacks, but I think probably France are the ones who are sitting back, you know, in the, not so much the long grass, but they're sitting back watching everyone kind of come back, and I think they're going to be primed and ready for their home World Cup next year.
Keane, there's rumours of an Irish mini tour going to take place in South Africa. No senior players going, fringe and young players only. Three games against three club teams in South Africa. Any names you could look out for who'd hoping to be on that tour?
Yeah, it's an interesting one, Ruby. It's sort of come out of the blue, but I can understand the logic of it. I think, you know, when it's kind of mooted first in the Sunday Independent yesterday, the immediate reaction was that, oh, this is a disgrace, you know, that like it's diminishing the URC and stuff. But you're not going to see Johnny Sexton and Tadhg Furlong going on this tour. It's going to be, I would say, a lot of the players who featured in the two Maori games in New Zealand, which was unbelievably beneficial, and Andy Farrell has been really strong in this. This is why he added the two games, and people thought he was mad adding two Maori games to a three test series in New Zealand. Had pretty much never been done before, certainly not by a country. It was almost like a mini Lions tour. So I think, again, having been over there and seen the development of certain guys like, we'll say, Kieran Frawley, Tom O'Toole, Gavin Coombs, Craig Casey, all these kind of guys, they're not going to face the toughest challenge. Like, I mean, they're playing three of the small, if it comes to pass, they'll play three of the smaller South African teams, but what they will get is unbelievably physical tests, but more importantly they'll have extra time in an Ireland camp, and I think that's what Andy Farrell and his coaches want. They want them involved in camp, like putting them under pressure every day, and without your leaders like Johnny Sexton and Tadhg Furlong, like I said, it will force guys even more to step out of their comfort zone, because you'll probably see the depth chart go down to the next rung as well. So even younger guys who might be way out of system. And look, it's all done with the World Cup in mind. I think the IRFU have probably looked at particularly the last couple of World Cups, and Ireland have fallen short, and some of the blame was put on a lack of depth. So the more time you can get younger guys involved, and it's, like I said, it's more in the actual, the pressurised cooker, I suppose, of what is a camp, and going away for 10 days, 2 weeks to South Africa, I think would be an unbelievable way of enhancing that.
Yeah, and same goes then for the women as well, going to Japan and the benefits that they're going to have when they come back from there. They didn't make it 2 wins from 2. It was a disappointing performance over the weekend, losing to Japan. But at the same time, you would think that they're going to come away from it and have learned a huge amount. And even when you look where they were a few months ago, compared to now, going through that summer tour and going to be coming off the back of it with contracts on the table.
Yeah, look, obviously they're disappointed. Like, no one wants to lose games, especially when they're representing their country. But I think if you had offered Greg McWilliams and the coaches a 1-1 draw in a series for the first time that a women's team has ever gone away, I think they would have snapped their hand off it. It's more the manner of, I think, how it happened. They were so good in that first test, and okay, they were missing a couple of important players, but again, we talked about the All Blacks in discipline. Ireland's discipline was terrible in that first half. I think they conceded 11 penalties. And usually the rule of thumb for international rugby, or any rugby really, is that you have to be in single digits. So to have conceded 11 in the first half is really not good. Their line-out was poor. But look, that's kind of the glass half empty. But if you want to look at the positive side, there's plenty of them. 9 new caps is amazing, really, to get that experience. And again, we talk about the emerging Ireland tour maybe getting the feel of like a pressurised cooker. I feel like sometimes it's stating the obvious, but you can't emphasise it enough that this women's team, when they're playing in the Six Nations, go back to work. They don't get the time to do proper reviews, to do proper, you know, recovery and that. So I think it'll be really, have been really eye-opening for that. And before the tour, I always got the sense that the first test was the one they could have got, because they, you know, backing it up the next week, they wouldn't have been used to, I'd say, a lot of the intensity that they would have faced, even behind closed doors. But what an opportunity to learn, what a country to go and visit, to go and tour. And
they got a lot of coverage too, because it was a standalone. Yeah. And like, in fairness to them, we got to know a lot of the players as well, because they did put out good content on their own channels as well, and all that stuff is important.
It was really good, to be fair. You have to give credit where it's due. Like, it's been a long time coming. It probably should have happened sooner. Yeah. But yeah, you get like you know, the public get to see the personalities of these players. And like I said, 9 new faces now. It'll be interesting to see once the Six Nations rolls around kind of the shape, the makeup of the squad. You look at someone like Dan O'Brien, who came in, was outstanding in Ireland, have been kind of really crying out for an out half, who can, you know, has a real good boot on her. Mm-hmm. So there's plenty of positive, and I think a 1-1 series is, there's a plenty to build on, I think, going into next year, because it also keeps, I think, the expectations in check. You know, a 2-0 whitewash over there, people could have went, Irish rugby, women's rugby is back on track, whereas it's kind of just a reminder that this is going to be a long road to get back to where they should be.
Yep, they're definitely in a good place though. Keane Tracy, thank you so much for coming in. We're going to take a very quick break, but do stay with us, because I see Greg Allen there waiting to come in to talk about Rory McIlroy.
Game on 2FM.
I hate what it's doing to the game of golf. I hate it. Like, I really do. I mean, like, it's going to be hard for me to stomach going to Wentworth in a couple of weeks' time and seeing 18 of them there. Like, that just, it just doesn't sit right with me. So, I feel strongly. I believe what I'm saying are the right things. And I think when you believe that what you're saying is the right things, you're happy to stick your neck out on the line.
Rory McIlroy there, speaking last night after his big win. Greg Allen is with us in studio. Greg, what was he talking about there?
Well, obviously he's talking about LIV Golf and the effect that it's had on golf in general, the professional men's game, his own position as a spokesperson, perceived to be on the side of the European Tour or the PGA Tour, which he obviously is. And that's probably as strong as it gets, because he's going to go to Wentworth in 10 days' time. Not even 10 days' time. He'll be there for the practice day on Tuesday. And he'll be looking at LIV Golf players, Graham McDowell, Sergio Garcia, whose wedding he went to, Graham McDowell, who used to be a great pal of his, certainly maybe still a great pal of his, Ryder Cup teammates, Ian Poulter, with whom he partnered up in Medina in 2012 for that extraordinary four-ball win, which precipitated the miracle at Medina in the following day in the singles, because they came back from an impossible position to win with that great partnership between McIlroy and Poulter, and obviously Lee Westwood, with whom he shared a management stable. They're all going to be there at Wentworth, and there he is saying basically he's going to find it hard to stomach teeing it up beside them. Doesn't get much stronger mm-hmm. than that in terms of his obvious dislike of LIV Golf. Hatred of LIV Golf, by the sounds of it, you know. Well, certainly hating what the LIV Golf has done mm-hmm. to the sport in general. But LIV Golf is another tour, wherever the money is coming from. Why shouldn't another tour have a role in the game in shaking things up? And LIV Golf has shaken things up. And look what the PGA Tour did last week. It was the most seismic announcement in the history of the PGA Tour since they broke away from the original PGA of America back in the late 1960s. So LIV Golf, as odious as it is for some, has had an amazing effect on golf, a lot of which has been revolutionary and positive. It's a really difficult conundrum.
It is a difficult conundrum, because you just think of Rory McIlroy and the relationship with those people, and that's friendships nearly gone when you listen to him speak that way. Maybe I shouldn't be speaking for Rory McIlroy, I don't know, but when you talk that way, that's the way it sounds, Greg.
Yeah, he's really with that statement. And consider that he made that statement last night in the aftermath of his FedEx Cup Tour Championship win, when really he should have been talking about how wonderful it is to finish the year with a victory of that magnitude, albeit not a major championship level of victory, but near as close to it as matters in golf. And certainly I thought it was really interesting to hear him just mention the words St Andrews and the Open in the interview directly as he came off the 18th, and you could almost hear the quiver in his voice as to how deeply that affected him, you know, losing on the final day a tournament that he felt he had in his grasp. And you know, so clearly on the same day that he is celebrating a big win in the FedEx Cup, he's saying these things about LIV, which just shows you how close to the surface it is on his day-to-day routine.
Yeah, and what's in his mind. What does it say about him, Greg, that he has been dealing with all of this and, you know, has been at the forefront, leading the charge, rallying the troops, yet at the same time, he's still able to play really good golf?
He's playing brilliantly. Like, I mean, the statistics are off the charts in terms of how well he's been striking the ball all year. But the clear difference for me, and I think a lot of people, is the way that he putts. He led the statistics in putting in one of the days of the 4 days in Atlanta. You know, Brad Faxon, when he was a PGA Tour player, was not known as being a good ball striker, but he was known as being one of the best putters of all time. and he is McIlroy's putting coach. There is no doubt that there is a seamless flow to McIlroy's routine, and the stroke looks really together, and sometimes it falls out of sync, but it seems like it's quickly back in sync with the help of Brad Faxon, and that for me is the key to what McIlroy has been doing. He's been turning what has been obviously huge ball striking talent into scoring numbers which are consistent because of the fact that he's now converting so many chances.
Craig, the Tour Championship is all, I know it is 72 holes, not 54, but it is a live format. There's no cut, 30 players, no one going to drop out, no one dropping out after 2 days, or if you follow what I'm saying. And then Rory starts double bogey, bogey. Does that format, did it work better for him? Did it allow him to chase? I mean, you look at the scores, Rory 67, 67, 63, 66, even Sungjae In 67, 65, 66 and 66. I mean, the scoring was incredibly low with no cut. It was a different kind of a competition.
Yeah, well, he only had 28 opponents, and, you know, it's only a par 70 course, so it's not a par 72 course, so those scores are like a 63 is 7 on a par, it's the same as a 65 that you'd normally see in a par 72 course. Look, he enjoyed the chase yesterday. There's no question that the six-shot lead that Scottie Scheffler had, because of the handicap system they have as a result of how well the players do in the FedEx Cup Series going into the final event, I was not a fan of that, and then suddenly McIlroy makes up the gap because of Scheffler's wobbles and his birdies in the first 6-7 holes, and it becomes one of the best viewing Sundays of golf in the entire year. So now we have to just say, okay, the jury's out on this handicap system in the final day of the FedEx Cup Tour Championship. It worked a treat yesterday.
So it's okay, Greg, to have opinions and then change them afterwards. We're all for that. It's all, we're out of time now, though. We will have the extra.ie FAI Cup quarterfinal draw tomorrow. So please do tune in for that. Greg, Alan, thank you so much for coming in. Ruby, as always, thank you.
Cheers, Marie.
Yeah, I'll see you next week. I'm not here tomorrow. Ruby is, though.
And with Shane Dawson.
All over the draw. Tara Kumar is up next.
RTE 2FM.